Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we're going to talk today about Project Hail Mary and Surratt, starting with Project Hail Mary, a movie I have been eagerly anticipating because I absolutely loved this book. But Mike, why don't you set the stage?
Well, as we're talking, the film has been out for a few weeks. Not only did it open really well, surprisingly well in some ways, but it has what the industry calls legs. Several weeks into the run, it's just holding up really well. And, you know, students and friends of mine, people who've seen it have really liked it. So with all of that positive assessment, I have to offer a minority view or a minority opinion to get Spielbergian. I don't care for the film all that much, but let me set up the film itself and then maybe my reasons for not liking it so much. There are at least two things to keep in mind as you head into this. The co-directors of the film are best known for the Lego movie, which all things considered, you know, considering it's essentially a feature length commercial, you know, is amusing. It's entertaining. It's very much pop cultural. And these guys know their pop culture. So there's that. It's going to be a comic mode. We kind of expect, you know, verging on glib, just like silly comedy oftentimes. So that's a given. That's the first thing to keep in mind by way of source material or source creators. The second one, as Marie alluded to, you know, it's based on a novel that also, you know, has its adherence. And I would single out also the fact that this novelist, Andy Weir, had also written The Martian. And that's integral to understanding this film in the sense thematically that what if you're a guy all alone out in space, you know, whether it's Mars or some other universe, whatever, you're out there alone, everything you're going to face there. So in many ways, the premise and really the operation of a film like this is going to be very similar in some ways to issues that came up with The Martian. So those are two things to keep in mind. So let me cut to the chase as to why I'm not crazy about this. And I don't want to, I don't know if we'll be spoiling things in terms of what happens to the character played by Ryan Gosling, Ryland Grace, when he's all alone out in space. But just simply to set the stage there, he's a molecular biologist. He has the scientific training. However, his career never quite took off in another sense. Not that there's anything wrong with being a teacher, because I'm a teacher, but he's a middle school teacher. And, you know, he loves his students. And he does really well. But the government knows he has a special capability because the world is facing a world ending threat. Namely, there's some alien entity that for reasons known only to the entity and the filmmakers, I guess, this entity is eating stars. I mean, not just like attacking, but actually like eating them, consuming them. And of course, our sun qualifies there. And so we're going to be in trouble. We got to send somebody out there to try to figure this out. So because he does have a background and you know, had done some academic writing in this respect years ago, they tap him. He's a very reluctant astronaut. And there are some very funny scenes where he basically says, I'm not qualified. You know, I'm the not an astronaut, you know, and it is very, it's very funny that way. But anyway, he's going to be sent out there. And of course, you're going to be put into a deep sleep, you know, for all the time it takes to get there and so on. And without spoiling too much, as we've already indicated, he's going to end up alone. Like other people on his ship didn't make it for various reasons. And, you know, he really is truly a loner up against a threat. Now, as to how much more we can say here, it's probably safe to say that he will encounter some alien life forms while he's out there. I mean, I don't know how much detail we should go into there, but this is where the film started to lose me. I know I obsess about running times, but this film has a running time of 156 minutes. And even if you like it, I think it wears thin after a while. And what happens is there should be a sense of menace, of threat, of being out there alone in this horrible entity that's going to eat your son and you too as part of that. But the fact that, you know, that's there, but it really is dissipated very quickly because it's such a relentlessly comic mode that the film is in. It just doesn't let go of that. It's just really glib, really facile that way. And for me, after a while, I thought, well, enough already, you know? And then at the point where he finally does make friends with an entity, and yes, I'll give away something, he actually gives it a name, Rocky. And of course, Rocky will have a mate, you know, Adrian. So, you know, all kinds of pop cultural joking there. At that point, for me, and this is my taste, it became a little too cutesy. it really was like, okay, well, it became Spielbergian in a pejorative sense, that you have a buddy-buddy movie in outer space, and you're essentially bonding with a rock, you know, or some rock life form. And it, you know, you might as well just call it E.T. I mean, it really is playing at that level. And again, you know, it's PG-13. It's very family-friendly. It is amusing there, but I just thought it was treacly after a while. The only thing that really kept me with it through the treacliness was the fact that Ryan Gosling gets a chance to show his acting chops. There are times in the film where he deliberately is a bit like Ken in Barbie, just in the sense of being like so clueless and out of his element in this and that. And he can do that really well, but he also has a more meditative quality as in, you know, contemplating his situation and the fact that, you know, he's really up against all these incredible odds. And this is where he does a lot of really, I think, impressive underacting. In other words, he just through, you know, a facial gesture, some nuance, he really suggests just what this guy's going through, what he's thinking. So there was more gravitas in Ryan Gosling's performance than there is really in the film around him. And so that really sort of kept me with it. But push come to shove, for me, it really was essentially a bit of a letdown after a while. And I realized very much that I was in a not just a minority, but maybe a tiny minority here. So let me turn it over to the majority at this point.
Okay, well, I will say I went in with trepidation because, like I said, I really, really loved the book. And, you know, a lot of things that really made the book good get the short shrift because you can't put the entire book into a movie. It's just too much stuff. So, you know, he sort of comes to in the ship, not understanding anything. And that in the book takes up a lot more time and gives you a whole lot more anxiety over what's going to transpire and the slow realization of how alone he is in space, how, you know, there's only enough fuel to go save the world but not get back. So it's a suicide mission, which I think is why it's got that bit of cynicism to it. And I thought the humor was wonderful. And my favorite part was him saying to the ship, you know, shields up, you know, because, you know, we've all seen Star Trek, right? And the computer tells him, yeah, we don't have shields. And he's like, why not? It was just such what a regular person would say. Like, what are you talking about? What am I doing out here if we're not, you know, in Star Trek territory? There's also I thought the interaction with him, Iraqi, was, I enjoyed it. Again, in the book, you get a whole lot more technical kind of, quote unquote, information about how difficult it is to connect physically and to figure out each other's language. And that I thought was all really, really interesting stuff in the book. But like I said, you cannot include all of that. But Rocky is sort of childlike in a way because, you know, it's a primitive kind of communication. He speaks in, you know, musical tones, which, you know, Gosling has figured out, you know, this tone means that, that tone means this. And so the things that Rocky says are very abrupt, you know, like thank or amaze, amaze. I found that charming in the book. Also, I listened to the audiobook, so I found that character's very likable. I understand what you mean about the E.T. cutesy, treacly thing. I cringe when I think about how Rocky's destined to become a plush toy, certainly by Christmas. But one thing I really liked about the movie and the book is that I don't feel like I've seen this movie before. And I think most of the time when you're talking about science fiction and movies, you know, there's certain things that always kind of happen and you feel like, yeah, I kind of know where this is going to go because I've kind of seen this movie before. I thought this was something fresh and new, and we won't give away the ending, but I thought the ending was perfect. Oh, and I don't think you need to worry about giving anything away with mentioning Rocky because I'm pretty sure they leaned on that in the trailer.
Well, trailers lean on everything, as you know, and they essentially give you the whole story. We're super cautious. Trailers are not super cautious. We have more conscience than trailers do. But no, where I beg to differ is just, to me, it did seem overly familiar in the sense that it was what I call Spielberg light. It really leaned on that. And even though you could easily point out differences between this and E.T., there's an essential thematic similarity there. And, you know, so much of the film then to me just felt like something I'd seen before or just like all too easy pop cultural joking, which takes away from the seriousness of it. And yes, even the cynicism in places, because you're right. It's essentially a suicide mission. You know, you can go out there and maybe save the world, but you're not going to necessarily be able to save yourself. And that does give you a lot to contemplate when I talked about Ryan Gosling being contemplative there. But, you know, if I'm going to go along with the silliness of it, and the film just has no shame in that respect. I mean, you know, to call it Rocky and give it, you know, the Rocky bride and the bride of Rocky, if you will. And when you mentioned the childlike qualities from now on, and when you mentioned the plush toy, I had the same fear, actually, to watching it, that would be part of the product line. But and I guess they could turn it out. And because he is childlike, they could call him Pebble even, you know. So one other thing that I did like about, and I don't want to seem like I'm relentlessly negative on the film. There are a number of flashbacks, explanatory flashbacks, which we haven't flashed back to yet. And that's always a kind of tricky creative issue here. Like, how much backstory do you want? How much do you need? There's an argument you can make that what you should do is keep it entirely confined to the ship, to its lone passenger, the incredible loneliness of that. You know, that would be a much more serious way, or gallows humor way, of dealing with it. Because you're right, some of the interaction with the onboard computer, a friendlier version of Hal, is, you know, mesmerizing sometimes. Like, what do you do if, you know, you want to have the shields up and the running shields? You're right. I mean, there's some funny references that way. But taking the flashbacks as a given, because we have them, they serve a certain purpose here. And they also help underscore some of the gravitas of it, because, you know, there are these NASA type administrators who have recruited him against his will, basically. It's almost like he's kidnapped and taken into it. And the leader, or one of the leaders of them, is played by a formidable actress, Sandra Hüller, who really does give it some dramatic heft there. And not that she's presented as, you know, an evil administrator, but she's a tough, no-nonsense administrator. I'll call her a tough love administrator. You know, you need to do this, and here's why. And she gives a performance that, you know, she's not going to make her character warm and fuzzy, but she makes her empathetic, that she's doing her job and you need to do your job. You need to go up in space and save humanity. And you know, she really makes the case for that. And some of those scenes down below, I think, are very effective there. Where it's more hit or miss is sometimes you get a flashback that really starts to fill in detail and you feel like you'll know them better as people. Some of the other flashbacks seem kind of arbitrary and choppy and just like tossed in for 10 seconds here or there. What was your feeling about that? Because what I'm making here is a structural comment or reservation, actually, that it just doesn't seem consistent always as to like how often and how to use the flashback material.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there in terms of a flaw, because I think the flashbacks are kind of lazy. But, you know, I came into the movie with the book in my head, so I kind of knew it was more fleshed out for me because I already knew. Again, they're not showing you all of the backstory that you get in the book, so it's choppy. Their choices are sort of strange of what they decide to include and what to exclude. And what you don't get, and you kind of touched on this, that you do get in the book, is that sort of sense of desperation where you come to in a strange place. You don't understand what's going on. The computer isn't even all that helpful while you're trying to piece things together. And you realize, wow, kind of like with Martian, out there all alone. And so when he does meet Rocky, it's not a matter of choice. He must somehow communicate with this other entity. And because it's so different, he has to just sort of approach it with whatever he's got. And then there's a really funny moment where they have connected and Rocky keeps following him around and talking to him. And he just wants a break. And he's like, you know, how do I get away from it? And of course, Rocky's response is, get away from what? It's like a little kid following around. There's moments like that where you realize you wouldn't be able to control the situation. You would only be able to react to it. And I agree with you. Ryan Gosling does a great job, because it could be really uncomfortable to watch a movie where somebody's talking to something that's inanimate, an inanimate object, for all intents and purposes. They're trying to make look real. You know, if it didn't work, it would ruin the whole movie.
It could have been green screen at its worst. Imagine you're an actor and you're on set and you have to talk to a rock and you can't even see the rock at the moment, right? And you're supposed to bond with it. I mean, you deserve an Oscar just for stepping onto the set for that one. Now, I'm far from a scientific expert, of course, but I thought like the bonding, the basic communication between them happened so quick, even by movie standards, that it sort of cut to the chase that way, as in suddenly they're communicating and it's like they're old pals or something. I thought, well, you know, you're very different life forms. And I know that some of the communication snafus, because you're right, it is funny when Rocky like attempts to learn English and you know, gets words not quite in the right order and so on. That is funny. But in movie time, it seems like just a matter of minutes before they actually have established some kind of bond. And I'm thinking, well, not that I want to sit in the theater for, you know, 156 hours, you know, till they get it right. But again, when I talked about the film being facile, I think it sometimes catapults forward that way, all too glibly, all too readily.
In the book, there's the idea of, oh, no, maybe this is a villain. Maybe I should be afraid. Works for a little while before they, you know, manage to connect, because it does feel like in the movie that it's just instant friendship. And how do we discuss what's going on? Because how do you know that's not a threat? That comes out much clearer in the book.
See, again, where the film is overly optimistic in that respect, also conditions back down on the ground, planet Earth, where we are, I think, as we speak, in terms of that, it's as if the nations of the world have all agreed on this mission, is like a sort of super United Nations and all. And just looking at the world around me right now as we speak, it doesn't seem like everybody would agree quite so readily on a mission plan. You know what I'm getting at? It just mm-hmm. has the most cheerful view of humanity that way. And I wish I shared that cheerful view.
Well, maybe it takes something like some entity eating all of the stars to get us there.
Not even that. Not even that.
Even that wouldn't work. Is there anything you would cut to bring it under 2 hours? Because I will always agree on cutting things, you know, just to make them fit. They cut enough to get the story across. But what would you have eliminated?
Well, I would rethink the flashback strategy. It seems to me there might be ways of just through a quick internal monologue or some reference, you know, within the film itself, within the limited world or extraterrestrial world of the ship. In other words, when he's up there, he can realize how all alone he is. I don't know how much flashback footage we need, like to the kids in the schoolroom and to what I call NASA control on the ground. You can make a case there should be some of that, maybe just to let some air out of the balloon, just to somehow put you in a different place as a moviegoer, so you're not totally stuck in the ship all that time. You know, it might be too claustrophobic. So I'm sympathetic commercially in that respect. But I think they probably could have tightened up some of the flashbacks, or as you said before, even cut a few of them out. And who would know the difference, right, if they disappeared? Secondly, what I would do is, because there is the cutesy friendship between a human being and a rock, I think, you know, you could cut a few of those back. Some of those scenes just are so extended, and the playfulness of them, for me at least, wears thin. But even if it doesn't wear thin for you, if some of those disappeared, you could be talking 10, 15, 20 minutes of running time right there.
Well, I would like to definitely recommend that everybody read the book or the audiobook. But I did love the movie. I did think it was very well done. But now we need to move on to Surratt. And I have been so looking forward to discussing this movie with you, Mike, because I really loved this movie, but I am having a really hard time explaining why. So set us up for this, Surratt.
I'm always happy to explain why. Surratt is one of the best films I've seen in recent months. And it received two Academy Award nominations, one for Best International Film and the second one for Best Sound. It has a terrific sound design. Mm-hmm. It's really spectacular. It's one reason why it should be seen in a theater, probably because visually, the way it's shot in the Moroccan desert and so on, but also aurally, the way it hits the ears. You want a great sound system. So unless you have that in your house, try to see it theatrically. The setup for it, really, it's a Spanish production officially, but it really, by way of production financing and casting and so on, it's really Spanish and French and so on. And likewise, in terms of where they shot, it's mostly shot in Morocco, but it's also shot in Spain. And it's giving you that kind of desert climate, that kind of desert environment. The story itself, I would describe, first, let's start with the title, Surratt. It's an Arabic word that means path or way. And the film itself is an existential journey. It's very much about a quest. Now, who's on this quest? There's a character named Luis, middle-aged man. His daughter had gone to a rave in Morocco. She's gone missing. So his real reason for being there is to try to find his daughter. So he and his son, you know, set off on that quest. As they do that, they hook up with a group of ravers who might well have known her or know of her fate, whatever. And it's all a bit murky because it would be murky for him. But just as a kind of desperation move, to go with them. And so the film then really takes him through hazardous terrain in terms of some of the people they meet and, you know, the environment itself at times and so on. And for me, it had all sorts of welcome echoes of earlier films set in a similar terrain and a similar existential journey motif. Everything from The Passenger to The Sheltering Sky to films in that part of the world with that kind of thematic material. And even going all the way back to the 1950s, a film like Wages of Fear, when you're taking a perilous journey, the suspense of it. This film, Surratt, has one of the best sequences I've seen in eternity, just one of the most suspenseful scenes. And without spoiling anything, but very late in the film, our protagonist and some of the people he's with, they're heading across a desert stretch that they don't know at the time as they're driving across. It is actually a minefield. And you never know, like, when is a mine going to go off and blow up your bus kind of thing. It is thrillingly well shot, and it just really gets you holding your breath there. I mean, I just was in awe of that scene alone. So I really like the film. I would not want to say too much about what they find or don't find as it goes along, but in a film like this, so much of it is what I call the journey and not necessarily a destination. So, this is something that we and I can talk about some more here.
No, I did like it as a road movie. Felt a little bit like Mad Max, sort of end of the world, when the father shows up at the rave. I did have, my own little flashback. About 30 years ago, I went camping in the Australian outback. And in the evening, they would have all this techno music. And people, it looked just like that. People, listening to the music and dancing to the music. And, the outback's very, very arid and dry. And so I sort of was immediately drawn in to the atmosphere. But then suddenly during the rave, the military shows up, and not in a, ICE agents looking to deport, but something terrible's happening. Everybody, you gotta leave. And you just have this weird sense of, is this like the end of the world? Is it like World War III? You don't ever find out. Well, you don't find out a lot of things, but you don't know what is actually going on. You just know the father's determined to find the daughter. He follows the ravers. They go a different direction. And then everything keeps ratcheting up. It's one perilous thing after another, but you can't turn around.
No, you have to keep moving forward. And the Mad Max analogy is apt in various ways. You have to keep moving forward. To stop is to die, basically. You have to move forward, as dangerous as it might be. You keep moving forward. And of course, this is a father desperate to find his daughter. So he's going to keep moving forward. But one thing that I was so impressed by in this film is many films will operate with a kind of delayed exposition. You'll find out what happens with the daughter. You'll find out more about this or that. This is a film that doesn't so much have delayed exposition as denied exposition. There's a lot that we're not given here. And I know that, that can be frustrating, but I found it fascinating as well as frustrating. For instance, you're right. The raves, many people could sort of connect it to, let's say, like Burning Man in our Southwest, mm-hmm. that kind of a phenomenon. But what would happen if suddenly the military showed up, but not in a way that's ever fully explained to you? That makes it even scarier. These mm-hmm. guys in uniform, like, is there some kind of revolution, some kind of, a repressive regime? What's going on here? And it's never fully explained, and it's just alluded to periodically. So in addition to the various environmental threats, you have these human threats, but they're so nonspecific, specific in the sense that they could kill you, but nonspecific in terms of who they are and why they would do that. That's why essentially it operates on a, when I say existential journey, it's operating on a more metaphoric level, basically. And so as you're watching it, if you're trying to get yourself located in a sort of, geographic or geopolitical way, the film will encourage you to do that and then deny you full satisfaction. So it's one reason why the father is so bewildered and so beleaguered is that he doesn't fully understand the environment he's moving through, and neither do we.
Yeah, it's also interesting that I think that the father and the son are both actors, and then the ravers that you meet are just regular people playing, I think, a version of themselves.
Almost everybody in the film is non-professional. You're right. You have a couple of pro actors. there, but otherwise, and you know what? Watching the film, you can't tell the difference, right?
Right.
The non-professionals are terrific actors.
Now, the interesting thing about the motley crew that we are traveling with is how damaged everybody is. Everybody looks like they have been through the war, literally. You know, there's missing teeth, there's a missing arm, there's a missing leg. You really get the sense that these are people who really have lived a tough, tough life. There's a hilarious scene where the guy with the peg leg takes it off and, you know, does this little skit with the nub. I mean, there's some moments that are actually really funny, and then maybe unintentionally funny, like the one where the dog eats the feces of somebody who had a.
You were searching for the right word. You wanted to find the right word.
I did.
PG-13.
But the person had been taking LSD, and the dog ate it, and then the dog stoned. That was, you know, worrisome. But at the same time, they made it sound like, you know, it's happened before. He's going to be fine.
Well, see, this doubles back on what I was saying about denied exposition. A more conventional film, if it had characters who are missing limbs, and some of these characters are missing limbs, and you know, missing teeth is the least of it, right? They're missing limbs and so on. There would be a conventional explanation. Oh, well, I got that when the bomb went off because I was fighting the revolutionaries, whatever, you know, hoo-ha, to explain it. Here, it's never explained. It's just a given that people are missing limbs. And in that respect, in terms of things missing, when he's traveling with these ravers, they are a cohesive group, but the relationships between them are not clearly defined always. There are one or two cases where I think, well, these might be romantic partners, another one or two where I'm just not quite sure. I mean, ultimately, I don't think it matters that much, but it's a sign of the boldness of the scripting and the direction here to have him traveling with people. And at first, there's a level of mistrust there, even when he first hooks up with them. If he needs help, will they come back for him? Will they help him this or that? But that gets worked through, but that element was there. And then even beyond that, he's never really entirely sure who he's with and what that's all about. And again, it's one reason why we as viewers always remain a bit uneasy, kind of tense. And even though we can ultimately, I think, more or less trust the ravers as essentially decent ravers, as ravers go, but just the sense that we never fully know them. And in some films, you might be quick to sort of take it to the seminar table and say, well, you need to script this character more fully and yada, yada, yada. But that's a very conventional way of thinking. This is a film that's outside of that box or away from that seminar table.
Now, like I said, I really love this movie, but I have a hard time saying why. As much as I enjoyed it, I don't think it's for everybody.
But I think that's a recommendation point. I mean, I think that this is a film that is really strikingly different. It's really bold in a lot of ways. It's not warm and fuzzy. You know, and I think you're right. It's not for all viewers, but for the viewers for whom it is, you're going to find it, I think, a really strong film. And other folks can just go see, you know, Project Hail Mary. Sorry, I'm being a snob today.
Okay, well, that does bring us to the end of this episode, but don't forget to check out our other ones at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, we have a whole universe of podcasts waiting for you. Simply search Dragon Podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also explore our full lineup and discover new shows at podbean.com/dragonpodcasts. That's podbean.com/dragonpodcasts.